Chapter 17. Contribute. Self-worth, altruism, volunteerism, philanthropy. How many times have you heard the axiom, money can't buy happiness? Do you believe it? Do you think it can? Money certainly buys stuff, and stuff can certainly bring pleasure. But could money actually make you unhappy? Or do unhappy people just wish they had more money? Or both? If constant reward that begets even more reward-seeking behavior is the killer of contentment, then just maybe the more money you make, the more unhappy you get? Could money instead be buying us unhappiness in the form of loss of contentment? And if so, can it be reversed? Many philosophers have commented on the negative impact of our materialistic society on contentment in terms of home life, relationships, family, spirituality, and community. Princeton sociologist Robert Wuthnow notes that 89% of Americans agree that our society is too materialistic. But when quizzed further, it appears that those 89% must be talking about the other 11%. In their own lives, they wish they had more money, a better home, and a faster car. Perhaps this is why we have seen so much political upheaval among those who identify with the middle class, who believe that our current economic system has left them behind. But this hasn't stopped them from spending, because they're convinced that without the latest gadget, they can't survive. The question is, does the misery of credit card debt outweigh the thrill of the newest iPhone? Madonna may have been the first material girl, but we are all living in her material world. Rather, I will argue that it isn't the money that ups your serotonin, it's what you do with the money and your time. Coco Chanel got it right. There are people who have money, and there are people who are rich. Money can facilitate the contribution you provide to others. Windfall profits may not be as profitable as you think. Let's look at some people who have had the opportunity to evaluate this axiom firsthand. Who goes from poor to rich quickly? Lottery winners. Do they become happy when they win the lottery? The lottery sure wants you to think so. Otherwise, what's the point of buying all those tickets? The first evaluation of lottery winners was in 1978, where 22 lottery winners, anywhere from $50,000 to $1 million, were compared with 22 controls, people whose financial situation had not changed, and also with 29 accident victims who had become paralyzed, metaphorically losing life's lottery. The lottery winners' happiness spiked when they won, while those of the accident victims plummeted in the very short term. But over the next several months, each group's level of subjective happiness returned to baseline levels. In fact, occasional studies describe financial ruin and even depression following a big monetary windfall. However, there are three problems with such studies. First, each examines different aspects of post-lottery life. Which definition of happiness are they using? And what if the examiners themselves don't understand the difference? As Kahneman and Deaton posited in Chapter 12, are they measuring pleasure, that is, life satisfaction, or are they measuring happiness, that is, emotional well-being? Second, how do you evaluate the winner's baseline state before they've won? Any study that requires looking backward must be taken with a grain of salt. Third and most important, who are these lucky lottery winners anyway? Are they one-time players who just got lucky? Or are they chronic gamblers who are in it for the variable reward and may keep jonesing for the next fix even after their metaphorical itch was scratched? Another way you could look at this is by observing who quits their job after winning the lottery. Turns out, the majority of winners stay within their career paths because that's where they derive their contentment through feelings of self-worth. They see their work contribution as meaningful. Check, please. Maybe more money could buy you better food. Better food, high-quality protein with souped-up tryptophan and omega-3s and lots of fiber, and even a sous chef to prepare it for you. Maybe that would make people happier. In fact, it could, but it doesn't. Analysis of eating patterns from the USDA Economic Research Service shows that as income increased from 1960 to 2013, the percent of money spent on food per capita decreased from 17 to 9.6%. Going further into the weeds, food consumed outside the home has increased from 26% in 1970 to 50.1% in 2014. So we do have a sous chef. But eating out doesn't necessarily mean eating well, even if you think you are. Does the soda come with free refills? Check out the dressing ingredients on your next Chinese chicken salad for proof. Furthermore, the lowest income quintile spends $4,000 per year on food. That's 36%. While the highest income quintile spends $11,000 on food. That's 8%. Altogether, the U.S. spends 6.7% of its GDP on food. Compare this to the French and the Japanese, who spend 14% of their GDP on food. But when you look closely at what we buy, it's not eggs, meat, or fish. Rather, it's corn, wheat, soy, and sugar, everything that's subsidized. In other words, America buys a whole lot of more pleasurable food for less money than the rest of the world. But in general, with the exceptions of some people on the two coasts, we're not buying better quality food. Consumer Reports, It's a Lemon. Psychologist Tim Kasser of Knox College has spent his career trying to tease out the answer to whether a materialistic mindset results in its own negative consequences. In developing a psychological tool called the Aspiration Index, Kasser identified four aspects of well-being in young people. First, self-actualization, that is, being comfortable in your own skin. Second, vitality, that's energy, alertness, feeling alive. Third, depression. And four, anxiety. It didn't matter whether he assessed adolescents, U.S. college students, or Gen Xers from other countries, the same pattern kept appearing. Those who valued financial success appeared to derive less contentment from life. This negative association between material goods and discontentment even held up under a rigorous meta-analysis. The more you have, the more you want. While aspirational life goals correlated positively with personal contentment even after controlling for financial status. In other words, working for your own personal benefit is the reward for your labor. But it is the impact of your work or your actions beyond yourself, how you contribute to the greater good, that translates into contentment. Could people grow out of this materialistic mindset? Would it make a difference? Kasser has studied young people in the U.S. and Iceland over time, for 6 months to 12 years. Guess what? If their affinity for materialism increased, their subjective well-being worsened, and vice versa. So the association holds up over time. Important, but that still doesn't prove cause and effect. Does materialism erode contentment? Or rather, could the change in contentment come first, driving materialism as sort of an haute couture booby prize? So, to determine causation, you need to design an intervention that either increases or reduces levels of materialistic thinking in order to see whether emotional well-being changes in the process. One set of investigators did a simple experiment. They divided some college students into two groups. The first group were told they were consumers, and the second that they were individuals. Surprisingly, the consumers responded to various presented consumer cues with materialism, selfishness, lack of cooperation, and lack of social contact, while the individuals exhibited none of these traits. Apparently, just being a consumer generates negative vibes. The takeaway from all of these examples is that wealth can exaggerate your current situation, but it can't fix it. Depression itself is not dependent on income, although the ability to seek and pay for treatment may well be. If you're unhappy with money and surrounded by people you don't trust, money will only make those problems worse. If you're fulfilled, have enough to pay for necessities, and enjoy a life of strong relationships, money won't actually make you more content, because the serotonin effect is not driven by wealth or income. Not in individuals, and not in countries. Ben Franklin said, "Money never made a man happy, nor will it. There is nothing in its nature to produce happiness. The more of it one has, the more one wants." A penny saved is a penny learned. Now it's time for you to do your own thought experiment. Don't consider yourself a consumer, powerless to the whims of the next fad and latest marketing scheme. Contrary to what Las Vegas says, you're more than your money. Think of yourself as an individual with unique morals and values, who provides your own unique contribution to your family, to your work, and to the world in general. Think of yourself as an individual with superpowers unrelated to your wallet or your bank account. How does that make you feel? Any empowerment? Before buying that next product that you just have to have that's going to make you happy, engage your prefrontal cortex first. Visualize yourself with this product 3 months into the future, 6 months, a year. Did you need it in the first place? Will it still make you happy? Will it help you to live your life in a better way? When you consider that product's worth in this way, do you still need it? My cousin has an entire shelf of anti-wrinkle creams. Each purchase, she swears, will make her look younger and therefore happier. Now, if that face cream could improve her self-image to the point where she would be less self-conscious and more social, that would be a product worth the expenditure. Yet most of them haven't even been tried before the next one is purchased. Kasser also showed how you can dissociate consumerism from capitalism. He developed a computerized financial education package designed to get kids to save rather than to spend money. He randomized a bunch of adolescents to participate in a 3-session intervention designed to decrease spending and increase sharing and saving, while another group served as the control. Both groups were followed up every 6 months for a year. Those who received the intervention demonstrated lower levels of materialism and higher scores on self-esteem, although anxiety remained unchanged. These various studies, while not proof, nonetheless argue that money is only worth the contribution it helps people to achieve. I'll show you who's boss. Contribution is the key concept here. Does contributing to the greater good or to society at large drive contentment? Can you derive contentment from meaningful work? Sociologists have wrestled with this for years, and the picture has now come into focus. There are jobs that make you feel good about yourself, and others that destroy your self-esteem. If your job or your boss, one, disconnects you from your values, for instance, pitting the bottom line against the quality of work, two, takes you for granted, 3, requires pointless or redundant work, 4, treats people unfairly, 5. Overrides your better judgment. 6. Isolates or marginalizes people. Or 7. Puts people in harm's way, physically or emotionally. Then you have a job that will generate significant unhappiness. You come home stressed and exhausted and head straight for the chocolate cake or the liquor cabinet. Note that both sets of job characteristics that impact your mental health are exclusive of salary. But if you're one of the lucky ones, you experience your job as 1, self-transcendent, that is, it matters more to others than it does to you, 2, poignant, challenging at difficult times, 3, episodic, with peak experiences that vary, 4, reflective, you can see the role that the completed work product will have on society, and 5, personal, that you're proud to have performed it. Then you have a job that can provide both life satisfaction and contentment. Note that both sets of job characteristics that impact your mental health are exclusive of salary. No wonder unhappiness at work is so rampant, in part due to job stress, and has worsened over the last 3 decades from 40% in 1987 to 52% in 2013. As the saying goes, find a job you love and you'll never work a day in your life. Until your position, your mandate, your location, or your boss changes. A friend of mine spent years as a guard at a maximum security prison. She got a great paycheck, but suffered immense stress and lack of sleep, and eventually became addicted to pills. Now she works in the floral department at a supermarket. She earns significantly less in dollars, but has gained immense life satisfaction in creating arrangements and making customers smile. She sleeps better, has kicked her pill habit, and is much happier. Not all of us can quit jobs we hate, and not all of us would find inner contentment in cutting and wrapping flowers for little more than minimum wage. But what if you volunteered to do so, or to create or participate in something that brought joy to others? On moral grounds. Obviously, individual personal achievements, such as doing well in school or getting a varsity sports letter, are great ways to derive personal satisfaction and will rack up points on the Kahneman-Deaton Life Satisfaction Index. But will those achievements drive contentment? It depends on what the underlying motive is. Altruism is the process of performing tasks that contribute to the greater good while deriving no personal gain or reward. Altruism doesn't activate dopamine, but instead drives serotonin. Many seemingly selfless acts aren't necessarily completely altruistic, as there may be rewards in such actions, like becoming teacher's pet, earning Boy Scout badges, receiving public service awards, tracking for faster promotion, etc. Rather, the question is, does your achievement contribute to a goal, that is, a goal that's bigger than you, that involves others? The answer uses what is commonly referred to as moral decision-making, processes that govern thoughts of interdependence, egalitarianism, justice, charity, and empathy, versus those that govern thoughts of independence, aggression, punishment, and callousness. Is moral decision-making anatomically and biochemically driven? There are 2 major classes of moral decision-making, and our old friends, the prefrontal cortex, our personal Jiminy Cricket, serotonin, and dopamine take center stage yet again. Altruism versus spite. First, have you ever cut off your nose to spite your face? Have you ever punished someone even though there were negative consequences for you as well? To wish others and yourself harm is the ultimate expression of lack of contentment. Known as altruistic punishment, or spite for short, this behavior stems from an impulsive and emotional reaction to what is deemed to be extreme unfairness. There are 2 routes to being spiteful. The first route to spite is to have a dysfunctional prefrontal cortex. Psychologists examine this area of the brain by playing the ultimatum game, which is a popular experiment in behavioral economics. One person is the decider, the other is the responder. The psychologist offers the players $100, conditional on whether the decider and the responder can agree on the split. Otherwise, both get nothing. The decider proposes whatever type of split he or she thinks is equitable, and the responder gets one chance, agree or get nothing. If the decider offers the responder 10%, and the responder thinks this offer is petty, the responder may well reject it, even if that means both players get nothing. Responders with damage, like head trauma, to their prefrontal cortex can't see the benefit of anything but an even split. They have reduced capacity for compassion, shame, and guilt, and reduced frustration tolerance. So it shouldn't be surprising that in the ultimatum game, they invariably get nothing. They can't see the prize because they can't see their spite. Also, people with lesions to their prefrontal cortex can't differentiate honesty from self-interest. How happy can you be when you're willing to screw both yourself and others, you can't tell the difference, and you can't even help it? The second route to spite is to lower brain serotonin levels. Normal volunteers played the responder in the ultimatum game twice, either after consuming a tryptophan-depleting drink, which lowers serotonin levels in the brain, or a control beverage. During the tryptophan depletion, responders couldn't accept the deal. They showed increased impulsivity and vindictiveness, which was predictable based on the change in tryptophan levels in their blood. This shows that reducing the molecule of contentment biochemically resulted in more impulsivity and spite behaviorally. Even giving tryptophan to an ornery dude can acutely improve his mood. A benevolent brotherhood of man. The second type of moral decision-making is called aversion to harm, either to yourself or to others. Most people would rather inflict pain on themselves than on others, in what is known as hyper-altruistic behavior. In a set of experiments, investigators looked at whether taking even just one dose of the serotonin reuptake inhibitor citalopram to increase serotonin, or the dopamine precursor L-DOPA to increase dopamine, could alter this hyper-altruistic behavior. The subjects didn't notice that they felt any different, but their behavior was. The investigators rigged a contraption that would unleash a series of shocks, either on the subject or on an unwitting victim. The subject was the decider, in that they could hit a button or not, but half the time, randomly, they ended up shocking themselves, while the other half the time, they shocked the victim. Only the decider was paid and received different amounts to hit the button or not. More shocks meant more money, while fewer shocks meant less money. The investigators found that in the presence of the citalopram, the deciders increased their harm aversion while strengthening their hyper-altruism. In other words, avoiding harm to others meant more to them than the money they earned. Conversely, when treated with L-DOPA, hyper-altruism was reduced, which meant that the money must have been more important than any remorse at shocking others. In other words, they turned a nice guy into an a-hole. More recently, investigators specifically targeted dopamine in the prefrontal cortex, our Jiminy, by administering a drug that knocked out the enzyme catechol-O-methyltransferase. That's the Pac-Man in charge of dopamine clearance we discussed in Chapter 3. And then had them play the dictator game. The dictator game is similar to the ultimatum game, but now the responder has no say at all. By increasing dopamine in the prefrontal cortex with the drug, the desire to be equitable increased. Even though they had nothing to gain, they still wanted to level the playing field. So it goes both ways. Our moral decision-making capacity is biochemically determined and potentially subject to influence depending on where and how dopamine and serotonin are acting. Then, bludgeon your Jiminy, inhibit the function of the prefrontal cortex through stress, sleep deprivation, or psychoactive drugs, even temporarily, and the full moon will awaken the werewolf in any of us. Bottom line, contentment and altruism co-migrate, as they are both dependent on serotonin, while reward and spite co-migrate, as they are both dependent on dopamine. Change the neurochemistry, change the emotion, change the behavior. Property management. How do these moral decisions play out in real life? You just can't go around giving people drugs and shocking them, but it's not all that hard to determine whether people are cooperative with each other in order to achieve the greater good. One seminal study looked at the psychology of almost 1,200 Han Chinese farmers based on one variable. Did they live north or south of the Yangtze River? North of the Yangtze, they grow wheat. They have their own plot of land and are independent of other farmers and their travails. Individuals within their societies demonstrate independence, like, I'd rather die my way than live yours. South of the Yangtze, they grow rice in paddies, where the water level is crucial. Since water runs downhill, the water level is not in your control. A drought or a flood in your paddy means a drought or a flood in everyone else's. So the rice farmers have to band together and work for the greater good. Thus, individuals have become interdependent, so that everyone is uplifted together. Literally, a rising tide lifts all boats. Interestingly, the rice farmers demonstrate signs of East Asian holistic thinking and contentment, that is, greater loyalty and lower divorce rates, whereas the wheat farmers show more signs of Western reward thinking, such as rugged individualism and higher divorce rates. The Humanitarian Award. So, can we change our brain's biochemistry? Of course we can, and without drugs. Jeez, that's what this whole book is about. Although we don't have the hard neuroscience behind it, one easy way to increase contentment and derive health benefits is through volunteerism. By offering your spare time to a cause bigger than yourself, without thought of personal gain, you can derive meaningfulness and contentment and eudaimonia. Several mechanisms may explain the association between volunteering and emotional well-being. Those who volunteer have a larger face-to-face social network and more opportunity to derive a sense of contribution and purpose. Physiological effects include reduced blood pressure and heart rate, suggesting reduction in anxiety or stress. A recent meta-analysis showed that volunteering improved depression, life satisfaction, and well-being, as well as resulted in a 22% reduction in risk for death. And a recent analysis of a large United Kingdom population survey corroborated improved mental well-being in middle-aged and elderly populations that volunteer. Perhaps volunteering can even change adolescence for the better. In a randomized study of Canadian high school students, those who volunteered to tutor elementary school kids for 4 months demonstrated lower BMI, lower inflammatory markers, and improved cardiovascular risk factors. Analysis of the intervention group suggested that those who increased the most in empathy and altruistic behaviors, and those who decreased negative mood, exhibited the greatest decreases in cardiovascular risk over time. So making the world a better place also tends to make a better you. The benefits of beneficence. If you don't have time to make the world a better place yourself, pay someone to do it for you. It's not the same thing, but it still works. Winston Churchill, brought up with all the advantages money had to offer, famously said, quote, "We make a living by what we get, but we make a life by what we give," unquote. President George H.W. Bush, in his convention's acceptance speech in 1988, spoke about the 1,000 points of light, imploring Americans to take up charitable causes. The good news is that among young adults ages 20 to 35, 75% gave something to charity last year, indicating that while they don't volunteer their time, they still subscribe to the notion of making the world a better place. In fact, philanthropy is a way to use wealth for achievement, to transcend oneself for the greater good. Then it should be no surprise that philanthropy is regulated by the same brain areas and neurotransmitters. Harvard psychologist Mike Norton likes to give away money to people who will also give it away. When research subjects are told to spend their experimental charity on themselves, their happiness index barely moves a notch. Yet when they are told to give that money to another person, called pro-social spending, their happiness increases by the amount they gave. Of course, the question is whether they would have felt the same giving money out of their own bank account instead of Norton's. Early brain scanning studies demonstrated that the reward pathway, the nucleus accumbens, as well as the prefrontal cortex, both light up in response to either taxation, that is, taking your money involuntarily, or donation, giving your money willingly, suggesting dopamine might play a role in both. However, these pathways have now been further teased out. Activation of the prefrontal cortex appears to be the arbiter between whether a potential donation is considered altruistic or charitable, as opposed to offensive or cloying. What role does serotonin play? In a small but ingenious experiment, 32 European students were randomly assigned to receive either an oral dose of tryptophan or a placebo. After rating their mood on a visual scale and doing some unrelated diversionary tasks, they were given 10 euros for their participation. At the exit, there was an opportunity to donate to one of several charities. On departure, those who received the tryptophan donated twice as much as those who received the placebo. Obviously, this is a small study and does not prove causation. Does this work in the opposite direction? Could giving make you happier? Well, we don't know for sure, but why don't you give it a try?